bewildered as he climbed down. Yes, that's the driver. How do you know? I don't know, but he's the only dwarf to come out of the Duke's residence. And I doubt his lordship employs many. He didn't look like a carriage driver. If Hadrian were to guess, he would have pegged the little guy as a gardener, or a stable hand, or, given the sack slung over one shoulder, perhaps a bearded child who was running away from home. The dwarf was dressed in a no-frills worker's tunic and belt, with wool pants and worn boots. He held a mud-stained cloak and a small sack tied at the mouth with twine. He struggled to work his way into the flow of the bustling people who jostled him as if he weren't there. "I know you don't like dwarves, Royce, but that doesn't mean every..." The carriage's footboard was ratcheted up for someone his size, so the driver was either a child or a dwarf. Everyone would have noticed a child driving a carriage, but look how people ignore the dwarf like he doesn't exist. Everyone blocks out what they don't want to see. And honestly, who wants to lay eyes on the likes of him? The dwarf walked past, and Royce slipped into traffic a few pedestrians back. "He works at the estate," Royce said quietly, as they followed the dwarf across the bridge toward the plaza. "Not full-time, I don't think. Probably hired for some temporary task, stonework most likely. And when they needed a driver for the Duchess, guess who volunteered?" "That sounds like a lot of guesses. Either that, or an 8-year-old was hired to drive the Duchess." Hawkers took advantage of the evening migration by shouting invitations and waving welcomes to the mob. Their efforts were stymied by the bells in the Tower of Gromgallimus, chiming 6 times. When the ringing finally ceased, the dwarf was through the plaza and heading up an alley that divided the cathedral from another large stone building. This sister building had a flight of steps leading to an imposing colonnade of marble pillars, above which "Imperial Gallery" was chiseled into the entablature. Both buildings had gargoyles, none of which were missing. The alley between the cathedral and the gallery was wider than the one in Little Gurham, but it was congested. This helped their pursuit. Royce kept 2 rows back from their prey, which required slowing down to let others pass. Moving on little legs, the dwarf wasn't speedy. The sun was on the horizon, its dying light already lost to them in the stone canyons of the central city. Where the buildings were so close, Hadrian thought he might be able to touch the walls on both sides of the street with his sword tips. The crowd began to thin as they followed a street that curved northeast. The buildings here were residential, shorter, less ornate. Hadrian spotted women on small wrought-iron balconies beating rugs, and numerous chimneys pouring smoke. The stone houses gave way to wood, with stucco and timber uppers, and the number of stories lowered with each successive block. By then, the sun was gone, the hazy afterlight competing with street lamps. The street they followed spilled out onto another, where a long wall ran along the one shoulder. 8 feet high, the barrier was made of brick and topped with metal spikes. When the dwarf reached it, he turned and followed along its length until he reached a gate. The wooden double door was open, and the dwarf passed through. Royce paused to study the latch and hinges for a moment. They were simple iron drawbolts. The oddity was the presence of latches on both sides. The doors could be used to lock people in or out. With a hesitant glance at Hadrian, Royce continued after the dwarf. Within the confines of the wall was a completely different world of tightly packed wooden shacks. The widest streets inside were the size of the narrowest alleys outside. Here, too, were cart vendors, but narrow as the streets were, the vendors nearly blocked them, causing pedestrians to squeeze around wagons and barrels. Royce and Hadrian had only traversed one block when Royce stopped. With concern, he looked up and down the street. "What is it?" Hadrian asked. "We're in trouble." Hadrian looked around. They were on the cobblestones of a narrow block gripped between shabby shacks where laundry hung from the sills of open windows. Residents gathered in small groups, some in front of doorways, others at intersections around trash fires, warming themselves. The alleged driver of the ducal carriage had stopped at one of these and talked with those huddling around it. "What's wrong? What do you mean? Don't you see?" Hadrian looked again, but couldn't find a threat.
"See what?"
"We stand out," he declared.
"Literally. Everyone here is short."
Hadrian looked again.
Royce was right.
All along the street, not a single person was more than 4 feet tall, and nearly all the men had beards of considerable length that were frequently braided or bound with ribbon. "What do we do now? Walk on our knees?"
Royce shushed him, guiding Hadrian into the shadow of a porch.
The thief focused on the group at the intersection's fire, where the driver had paused to chat with 5 other dwarves. They mostly stood with arms folded across their chests, but on occasion they would hold out their hands to the heat. At that distance, Hadrian couldn't hear what they said, but he suspected Royce could.
"What are they saying?"
"Arguing about the weather," Royce replied.
"How can you argue about weather?"
Again, Royce motioned him to silence, and Hadrian leaned against the grayed wall of the building where they sheltered. In the window, a sign hung. Maybe it said, "Help Wanted," or "Room to Let," but Hadrian couldn't tell. It wasn't written in any language he recognized. The window itself was oddly low, and the pair of rocking chairs on the porch looked to be for children.
"This is like a miniature version of the world." "I feel like a giant," he told Royce.
He turned back to the ring of dwarves around the fire, where a heated argument was growing.
2 of the dwarves gesticulated wildly, thrusting fists over their heads. Even Hadrian caught the occasional shout of, "Don't tell me what is and what isn't!"
"These people take their weather seriously."
"Not arguing about the weather anymore," Royce reported.
"What are they talking about?"
"Don't know. Something to do with the Calaeans, Mir, and the coming of spring. Our guy isn't too popular either. Nor is he happy with them. And nobody likes the Duke. And..."
Royce tilted his head to listen.
"They're holding a meeting. An important one in the Calaean precinct.
Sounds like it has something to do with an alliance."
The streets were emptying, and windows shuttered, as the night erased the day's earlier promise of coming spring. The cold of winter had returned, reminding everyone it wasn't yet finished. The driver hoisted his sack and bid a less than fond farewell to those around the fire. He headed off into the darkening streets.
Royce waved at Hadrian, and together they followed.
The dwarf stopped at a tiny butcher shop. There he haggled, in an unfamiliar language, over one of 3 chickens that hung from the porch rafters. A great deal of pointing, scowling, and foot stomping accompanied the conversation. The bird under debate was so small and scrawny that Hadrian questioned whether it was a chicken at all. If not for the white feathers, he might have guessed a crow. In the end, the driver reluctantly handed over coins and took the pair of legs, swinging the chicken as he walked. Then he stopped at a wheelbarrow, where what appeared to be an elderly husband and wife sold firewood. The driver picked out 3 splits, as if he were choosing produce at a market. Burdened as he was with an armload of wood, his sack, and a scrawny chicken that he continued to heedlessly whip about with the swing of his arm, the dwarf continued until he came to a tiny shack. The wood siding had been weathered to a dark grey. The upper story jutted out over the lower, creating an overhang that shadowed the door. A light shone from inside. And without a knock, the driver entered. The shack had 2 glassless windows. Tattered cloth covered both, but one covering was ripped, and through it Royce and Hadrian spied on their suspect. To Hadrian's shock, more than a dozen people were within. Children and elders, male and female, they all crowded into the small space of one room. The light came from a cook fire where a surprisingly cute dwarven lady took the bird from the driver. With children pulling on her apron, she held up the chicken, made some comment, and then kissed the driver on his nose. The two laughed. Instantly feeling guilty for spying, Hadrian left Royce to monitor the dwarf while he found an abandoned crate to sit on near a rubbish pile. After Royce's commentary, he'd expected that the dwarf was on his way to some nefarious hideout, a creepy tower, or ancient ruin where Jenny Winter was chained to a wall or suspended over alligators. Instead, he was snooping on the hard-working provider for a warm and loving family. Their poverty made the act of spying even more distasteful. Hadrian hadn't been invading merely a gathering, but an event as sacred as a funeral. Most of the garbage pile he waited in consisted of wood chips and strips of bark, which made Hadrian think it might not be rubbish at all. In a household so picky about buying firewood, he couldn't imagine them discarding anything that burned. Hours went by before Royce approached Hadrian. The thief had something small in his hands. "Not a stoneworker," he said, holding up an exquisitely carved wooden figurine of a rearing horse, polished and lacquered to a honey finish. Every muscle and the individual strands of hair in its mane and tail were rendered in startling detail. "It's beautiful." Royce nodded. "There's a shed around the other side, filled with things like this. Why doesn't he sell them?" Hadrian looked over at the house. "I don't know what they pay him at the estate, but I would think such craftsmanship would pay well. This is better than what I've seen in the shop windows." Royce nodded, while still looking at the carving. "We spending the night?" Hadrian asked. Royce shrugged, then pivoted abruptly. Hadrian heard it too. The front door of the shack clapped. The woodcarver and alleged driver of duchesses was on the move again. With cloak on and hood up, the dwarf appeared significantly more sinister than before, as he slipped out of the shack and set out into the night. This time he clutched a bread loaf-sized box in his arms and presented the image of the quintessential villain of 100 children's stories. Grönbach, the little bearded dwarf, bent on evil. As the driver scurried through the shadows, Hadrian had no trouble believing the tales of a nefarious dwarf. The scene was fable perfect. Except he had also seen the earlier moments when a tired worker dragged himself back to his impoverished family and provided them a miserable excuse of a chicken. Kisses from a loving wife were never part of the Grönbach myth. He didn't even have a wife or children. In the fairy tales he was a monster, and his reputation cast a shadow over all dwarves. The little guy moved with more speed, darting up the maze of narrow streets. At one point, he broke into a trot, and Hadrian was certain he'd been discovered. But after a few yards, the dwarf slowed to a quick walk. If he had looked back, the driver would have spotted Hadrian, who stalked with his own hood up. The dwarf certainly would wonder about the tall man with three swords, strolling late at night in a dwarven enclave. But he wouldn't see Royce. While the thief was much closer, he was slipping from shadow to shadow and appearing as little more than a flutter, a faint disturbance that could have been the corner of a firewood tarp blown by the wind. But the dwarf didn't so much as glance over his shoulder as he maintained a generally northeastern course, avoiding windows, doors, and firelight. Convinced they were finally on their way to the sinister ruined tower and alligator pit, Hadrian was puzzled when the dwarf approached a figure at the entrance to a cemetery. The burial ground was a modest patch of headstones, walled in by a tight congestion of stone buildings, one of which might have been a small church. The tombstones, however, were marvellous. Even at a distance, they revealed artistry. Dwarves were known for stonework as much as for kidnapping young women, and the statuary in that yard was more beautiful than any he'd ever seen. Most were depictions of people, the deceased, Hadrian assumed. These weren't the diminutive, malevolent, hooded monsters of a host of cautionary tales, but the exquisite heroes of their own stories. Straight, proud, smiling figures looked up at the sky, or down with empathy, at those who might come to grieve on their behalf. This is how they see themselves, he thought. Combining this sight with the scene in the shack, Hadrian began to wonder if there would be an alligator pit at all. The dwarf walked directly up to the figure at the entrance. No hesitation, no greeting either. The fellow waiting at the gate of the cemetery was tall, thin, and dark-skinned, with hair that was mostly grey. Royce looked backward with apprehension, and in his gaze was a wealth of information. He wasn't so much looking for anything as telling Hadrian to be wary. One slaughterhouse wagon was more than enough. Not that another runaway cart would be a threat again. This tiny street was peppered with windows, doors, and a host of other obstacles. Barrels, awnings, porch steps, and piles of garbage. Royce wasn't saying, "Watch out for another killer wagon," but rather, "I don't like the feel of this. Keep your eyes open for a trap." The fact that Royce had exchanged so much information with a look disturbed Hadrian. There was no doubt he had heard Royce correctly on all counts, and Hadrian's utter confidence in that silent discourse only added to the anxiety that he was harmonizing with Royce's mind. While that was good for work, Hadrian couldn't shake the sense that it was bad for everything else, like his sanity. Sticking close to the walls and staying out of the moonlight, Hadrian crept up to where Royce stood at the base of the three-story church, the only stone building in the neighborhood, which obviously predated everything around it.
98 swords, half as many shields.
Why so few shields?
Shields aren't as important, and are harder to store, the dwarf said. We haven't stopped. Production has slowed, sure, but that's all. Don't forget, we're the ones carrying the burden. The rest of you aren't out a single din. You're just scared, the Kalayan replied. We all had great hopes the ransom would succeed, but the feast is the day after tomorrow. Spring is coming, my friend, and whether I'm the seed, the rock, or the sod, I fear the plough.
The dwarf nodded.
Time's up. 100 swords is the best we can do.
He held out the box.
But with this, it should be more than enough.
I'm more frightened of what you hold than the swords.
The Kalayan eyed the container as if the dwarf were waving a crossbow in his face.
Griswold, if it becomes necessary, will you use it?
This one is yours.
The dwarf handed the box to the Kalayan. He took it slowly, gingerly, and held it away from his body, as if a swarm of angry bees were inside.
With that, I can ask the same of you. Will you use yours?
The dwarf asked.
If it comes to it, what choice do we have? 100 swords won't be enough, and Vilar will use his. Giving him a monopoly on such power would be the pinnacle of stupidity. We have a responsibility to act as safeguards to one another. And then there's the sacrifices to think about, not to mention what happens afterward.
That's something we'll decide when we get there, if we get there. One can't start building a house without determining the size and shape of the foundation.
Comments like that are what make others see only your height,
the Kalayan said.
You're reinforcing false ideas. You're a woodcarver for Novron's sake.
The dwarf laughed. I'm a woodcarver, but in no way is it for Novron's sake.
They both smiled. Then the Calaean stretched his neck and peered up the road. Hadrian and Royce froze, but the Calaean didn't see them.
Where is Filar?
The dwarf gave his own casual glance.
He's usually the first one here, isn't he?
Do you think?
Royce spun and shoved Hadrian out into the street. Off balance and bewildered, he staggered backward into the moonlight, catching the attention of the dwarf and the Calaean. They both stared at him in shock and fear.
What the—
Hadrian began, just as the thief sprang to his side. An instant later, a massive block of stone struck the street where the two had been standing. It shattered, kicking up a small cloud of dust. Looking up, Hadrian spotted a silhouette peering down from the roofline of the church. It withdrew from sight, melting into the darkness.
Meet you back at the boarding house,
Royce said quickly, as he leapt to a windowsill. From there he scaled the stonework to the church's roof, where he, too, vanished. Hadrian looked back toward the graveyard. The dwarf and the Calaean were running away in opposite directions. Hadrian had always considered himself a good runner, but that night he was handicapped by racing in the darkness of an unknown city. Weighed down by three swords while chasing a slender man with a solid head start didn't help either. Unable to pursue both, and already knowing where the dwarf lived, he chose to follow the Calaean. The good news was that his target appeared to be considerably older, and he still protectively held the dwarf's box.
The contents must be valuable, or he would have dropped it before running.
The Calaean cut through an alley Hadrian didn't know existed, pulling down stacks of empty crates to block his pursuer's progress. By the time Hadrian emerged from the debris-strewn alleyway, the Calaean had gained a greater lead and was openly sprinting down the center of the next street. Hadrian didn't know what time it was, but he guessed it was after decent folk went to bed. Few remained on the cobblestone thoroughfares, and while all of them stopped to watch, none made any attempt to stop his pursuit. The Calaean tried to lose him by cutting through more alleys, and he succeeded. Hadrian lost sight of his target. The man was gone. Guessing that the man would head for the same gate that marked the exit from the dwarven community, Hadrian ran for it. He was rewarded by a glimpse of the Calaean racing out. He headed south toward the harbor, sandaled feet striking the stone in rapid slaps. In the growing fog of the silent streets, Hadrian could hear the man long after he'd lost sight of him. This was the only noise the Calaean made. Hadrian generated a multitude of sounds, clapping swords, the flap of his cloak, and the pounding of his boot heels. Luckily, the Calaean was slowing down, getting tired most likely. Darting into a series of dilapidated houses, he dodged a ladder and jumped a pile of manure that Hadrian slipped in.
He didn't fall, but it was close.
They both ducked under a clothesline loaded with clothes someone had forgotten to take in. With boots still slick with muck, Hadrian ran past a cascading avalanche of busted crates, over an open sewer grate, around a brimming water barrel, and into a yard enclosed by a battered wooden fence. The Calaean managed to leap the stockade-style wall, and for precious seconds, Hadrian lost sight of him again. By the time Hadrian had cleared the fence, he'd once more lost his prey. The barrier was merely a dividing line between one property and another, separating an alley filled with a stack of broken wagon wheels and one filled with dented buckets. The Calaean could have gone left or right. Rather than running off blindly, Hadrian stood still, held his breath, and listened. He had no idea where he was anymore. They'd raced up a dozen different streets. The architecture was back to four-story buildings with stone bases and timber and stucco uppers. Damp, salty air accompanied a growing level of fog, which reduced his visibility to half a block. His only clue was a familiar pungent fragrance, a pervasive incense burned in many homes in Calais.
Slap, slap, slap. Off to his left.
He darted around the buckets and back out onto a street, another tiny affair. Again, he had a choice, and once more Hadrian paused to listen. He waited, but heard nothing.
Is he hiding?
Hadrian was exhausted after the long run. The old Calaean had to be too, or maybe he'd realized it wasn't such a good idea leading his pursuer back to his home. Or perhaps he had simply taken off his sandals. Slowly, carefully, trying to make as little noise as possible, Hadrian made a calculated guess that the Calaean had continued in the same general southerly direction, and crept that way. Reaching an intersection, he found a lonely street lamp illuminating three choices. Straight ahead lay the masts of ships, black against the starry sky. To his right, the dark edifice of the cathedral towered over rooftops and the bright white fog. Its lower reaches were illuminated by the increased presence of street lamps. To his left, there was only darkness.
I'd pick darkness, Hadrian thought,
and started down the dismal street. He'd only gone a few steps when he heard a wet, tearing noise. In daylight, while surrounded by a crowd of smiling friends, the sound would have made him cringe. But in a strange, dark place of mist and twisting streets, it made him shudder. This wasn't a happy noise. Hadrian drew his short sword. The metal made a soft ring as it left the scabbard. Something moved. Hadrian saw little more than a shift in shadows. But the sound was a harsh, sudden jerk, the sort a startled deer might make. There was a thrash, something knocked over, and then silence. Hadrian guessed his prey was fleeing again, and quickly ran to the corner. He tripped, and this time he did fall. He hit the hard alley floor with his left shoulder and knee, grunting with the pain that shot up his thigh. His knuckles struck the cobblestones hard enough to make him let go of the blade. Instinct made him roll to one side and snatch up his weapon as he did. He raised the blade in defense against the expected attack. No one was there. He was alone, lying on the ground in a dark alley, feeling foolish. Hand throbbing, knee aching, shoulder sore. He once more held his breath to listen. All he heard was the distant ringing of cathedral bells.
It's official. I've lost him.
Royce would never let him hear the end of this fiasco.
You couldn't even catch an old man.
Angry and disappointed, Hadrian looked for what had finally tripped him up. It took several seconds of staring to understand what he was seeing. It failed to make sense in so many ways that his mind took a great deal of convincing to finally accept it. Three steps back, the Calaean was sprawled on the wet stone. Hadrian knew him by the burgundy wrap, the green scarf, and the box. These features provided the identity rather than his face, because he no longer had one. Chapter 15. Bird Hunting. Royce leapt from the roof of the four-story building and landed on the slate tiles of the structure on the opposite side of the street. He ran to the ridge line and sprinted along it. A slender figure in a dark, hooded cloak ran with abandon ahead of him. Racing entirely across rooftops, Royce had pursued his quarry out of the congested dwarven district toward the center of town. At that moment, the cathedral's soaring tower began tolling ominous peals of cascading notes, providing musical accompaniment for the drama unfolding against the starry night sky. With buildings tightly packed, the canopy tour had been without serious challenge. Still, Royce's prey had been impressive. He'd proved more than comfortable with heights. He was fast, agile, and clever in his maneuvers. The moment his quarry had decided to make his flight across the high ground, Royce experienced a giddy sense of victory. Rarely did a target act so agreeably. Rather than trying to disappear into the unfamiliar maze of city streets, this guy was like a bird trying to escape a shark by diving into the ocean. Royce's sense of jubilation was soon replaced with a rush of excitement at finding an unexpected challenge. This bird, he was stunned to discover, could swim. Ahead was trouble. They were at the end of the easy jumps. Before them was another street-imposed gap, a wide one, and on the far side, the vertical wall of a much taller building. Royce expected his prey to slow, to hesitate, to double back or climb down. Any of these would have granted Royce the opportunity to catch up to a lethal distance. Instead, once more his little bird did the unexpected. Reaching the end of the building, the figure didn't slow or pause. Instead, he made a running leap directly at the wall of the taller building. He missed the wall and smashed through a window, taking down a curtain. Royce was right behind, diving through the narrow opening of shattered glass. He expected his bird to be on the floor, tangled in cloth and bleeding from cuts. All he found was the glass-laden drape and an open door creaking slightly. Royce rolled to his feet, bolted out the door, and raced down a corridor into a very strange place. He almost ran into a knight, before discovering it was merely pieces of armor stacked in the shape of a man. It even held a spear in one of its gauntlets. Royce found himself on an upper-story indoor balcony that circled a large four-story chamber. No one was in the building. This was a public business of some sort, and at that late hour, the place was dark, except for the glow of street lamps entering the windows. Below were numerous displays, pedestals supporting statues, books, musical instruments, tools, even clothing on stuffed dummies. In the center stood a huge chariot and two stuffed white horses. Much of one wall was covered in a mural depicting the landscape of an impossibly grand city lit by a perfect summer sun. Paintings in lavish frames covered the other walls. Hanging from the ceiling were still more oddities. The most eye-catching was a massive creature that looked to be a dragon suspended over the center of the chamber by several chains. The thing was huge, but not real. It appeared to be made of painted cloth, wrapped over a wooden frame. Distracted by the bizarre nature of the place, which seemed to be some kind of curio shop, Royce gave up several seconds to his fleeing quarry. The sound of shattering glass pulled his attention back. He spotted the figure breaking a window on the far side and raced around the balcony to the broken opening. Outside was a sheer drop to the street. His prey had gone up. The climb wasn't trivial. Several of the handholds were no more than fingertip-sized, but his bird had scaled the wall quickly. Before Royce was halfway up, his quarry was on the roof. A moment later, a series of slate shingles flew his way. The first barely missed him, shattering on the stone to the left of his face. Royce had to duck the second, which he heard as it passed. More were coming. With a lurch, Royce leapt up and caught hold of one of the grotesque downspouts. This one looked like an evil, sharp-toothed dog, snarling and extending a long serpent's tongue. He hugged the statue around its neck as another shingle clipped his boot. The impact stung. If it had hit his head, Royce would have fallen. The next shingle came, this one aimed higher. Royce managed to catch it as he dangled one-handed from the dog's head. His enemy boldly straddled the ridgeline. The rising moon was behind him, giving a silvery outline to his whipping cloak that snapped in the wind. With his adversary's hood up, all Royce could see was a nose, part of a cheek, and a chin. "I'm chasing myself." Royce waited until his opponent bent down to pry up another slate before throwing the one he'd caught. Slate shingles weren't knives, and his throw was off. Royce had aimed at the hood, but it hit his target in the thigh. Despite the bad aim, he was rewarded with a grunt. Royce pulled himself up on top of the dog's head, then sprang to the eave, catching the lip. Another strong pull, and he was crouching on the roof. He scanned the ridgeline. The shingle thrower had abandoned his attack and was back to running. He sprinted along the peak, then veered right, following a long gable. It acted like a plank extending off the side of a ship. By the time Royce reached the gable, his prey had made the long jump across the gap of an alley, which separated the strange shop from Grom Gallimus. The same alley where, only hours earlier, he and Hadrian had followed the dwarf. His hooded bird landed safely on the far side, touching down on another gargoyle, its ugly head protruding out from the side of the cathedral's buttress. Royce made the same leap, landing on the same stony head, a hideous lion with fangs that extended well past its lower jaw. By then, Royce's twin was already climbing up the buttress's pier, a sheer column of stone. They were already up 5 stories. Royce could see the plaza out front, where the massive statue of Novron looked tiny. What he'd thought to be a curio shop was the Imperial Gallery, whose roof he was now looking down at. Still, they were only halfway up the side of the cathedral. Slab after slab, ornate divider after divider, Royce scaled the stone pier in pursuit. Who is this? Royce had never encountered anyone who could match his skill at climbing, his ease in high places, or his ability to see in dim light. This hood and cloak really could be his long-lost brother. With each foot they scaled together, Royce's respect for his adversary grew. Even if this guy wasn't connected to the job, Royce couldn't give up this chase. I've got to find out who this is. When he reached the top of the pier, Royce's rival swung around the little pointed cap and ran up the incline of the flying buttress. If the long, rising arm that held up the side wall had been a bridge, it could have spanned half the Roche River. Running up its slope, they both gained significant height. Reaching the top, they jumped a stone railing that protected a long balcony just below the eaves of the main roof. They were above the great oculus window. Above the creepy statues of old men in draped robes who glared down with stern indignation. But above them still, more gargoyles jutted from the edge of the roof. No two alike. Royce's adversary ran down the length of the open walkway, which ran along one side of the church-like battlements on a castle. At the balcony's end, the hood and cloak had only 2 choices. Up or down. Stakes were literally higher now. The wind at that height was brutal, and unlike all the previous roofs, Grom Gallimus's pitch was sharp as a miserly wedge of cheese. Royce trotted up, waiting to see which way his prey would choose. When his opponent went up, Royce found himself oddly pleased. This game of cat and mouse wouldn't end with a whimper. Far too steep to walk up, the roof offered vertical ribbing that divided the sets of shale shingles. Royce's opponent used them to pull himself along the slick surface. What the roof didn't offer was a usable ridgeline. A tall fin of decorative metalwork crowned its peak. Royce's enemy shimmied higher, kicking the slates and creating an avalanche with his heels. Displaced shingles cracked, and the broken bits fell down toward Royce. Shifting left and then right between the ribs, he dodged the cascade. With each shift, he climbed higher until he, too, reached the ridgeline.
"You've run out of places to climb!"
Royce shouted above the rush of wind that snapped both their cloaks.
"What now?"
His adversary's hood tilted up, assessing the bell tower. As far up as the two of them were, the tower of Grom Gallimus went up half again as high. While not the height of the crown tower, it was nothing to scoff at.
"You'll never reach it before I get you,"
Royce told him, as he continued to inch closer.
"And what good would it do?"
His quarry turned to face him, and as he did, the wind caught the hood and blew it back. A pale face, adorned with arched eyebrows, accentuated a pair of angry, angled eyes. Swept back hair displayed a broad forehead, and ears that came to sharp points. That explains a lot. In at least one sense, we are related. The two faced off with cloaks snapping back and forth like cat's tails, two male tabbies having a deadly dispute over territory.
"Who are you?"
the mere demanded, with a harsh eastern accent. The words kicked out from behind clenched teeth.
"You don't know?"
Royce was puzzled.
"I'm the guy you tried to crush with a rock. Is that something you do to random strangers?" "You shouldn't be in Rochelle. Our business is our own. Leave now, and you can go in peace. If you continue to interfere, you and your friend will be added to the list."
The mayor looked off to his right, searching for an escape, and finding none.
"There's a list."
Royce lunged forward, hoping to catch his prey's wrist. Just as quickly, the mayor jerked away. He tried to switch his grip, but missed with the other hand, his balance off, his footing lost. Down he went, on the far side of the roof, sliding across the surface of the slates on his back, like a kid riding a sled. He pushed out with his feet against the ribbing, trying to stop, but the momentum was too great. Royce held his breath as he watched. Hanging on to the wrought iron crown of the peak, it was all too easy to imagine taking that trip, the conclusion of which Royce already knew. Coming to the end of the roof, the mayor made a desperate grab for the railing of the balcony, but missed it by more than a foot. His speed skipped him well away from the walls of the cathedral. There wasn't a scream. Royce appreciated that. He had no idea who had just died. But under different circumstances, he might have made a valuable addition to Rhaera.
"Just as well," he thought. "We'd have had to change the name."
Taking a more deliberate and far slower route, Royce descended to the balcony and peered over the railing. Below lay buttresses. The dead man had most likely missed hitting them. Below that lay the river. Royce climbed the rest of the way down, taking his time, not only because he'd seen the repercussions of a tiny mistake, but because he felt no urgency. He expected to spot the mere's body impaled on one of the gargoyle snouts, or at the very least, on the bank of the Roche River. But Royce had found neither. He walked the length of the riverbank, first south, then back north, and saw no evidence of a body. Could he have hit the river? Royce looked up at the slope from Grom Gallimus's roof. Theoretically, it was possible. Still, the fall would have been painful, and likely fatal. Royce scanned the surface of the moonlit water for any floating, body-sized object. Nothing. It was as if his bird had flown away. Royce had spent more than an hour searching the base of the cathedral and the banks of the river, just to be thorough. Satisfied, he returned to Hemsworth House and walked up a deserted mill street just as Hadrian was walking down. Only those up to no good, or people with no place to go, would be outdoors at that hour. Royce had to remind himself that he didn't fall into either group, at least not that night. It felt strange, and yet it was an altogether too common reality as of late. Over the last few years, Royce had found himself acting within the limits of the law. They were making more money with less risk, yet it felt wrong, like writing with his left hand or walking backward. The two met in front of the boarding house in a bank of fog.
"Any luck?" Hadrian asked.
Royce shook his head. "Had a fun run. Got a squirrel's tour of the city." Hadrian looked shocked.
"He got away from you?"
"He took a tumble. Pretty sure he's dead." They spoke just above a whisper. The fog demanded it. Royce always enjoyed a good fog. It reduced visibility while increasing the distance sound traveled. and since it usually occurred during the shifting temperatures of night or early morning, it proved a thief's friend and an assassin's weapon. Spring and autumn were the seasons for lowland mist, and rivers were its breeding ground. That night, the river was working overtime, and the oil lamp in front of Evelyn Hemsworth's home served to do nothing but illuminate the white haze.
"Any idea who he was?" Hadrian asked.
"Amir," Royce replied. "Said we should leave, but we are going to be added to a list."
"There's a list?"
"That's what I said."
"And why both of us? I didn't chase him."
Royce smiled. Maybe he didn't want you to feel left out.
"Oh, well, at least someone thinks about me."
"What happened to the dwarf and the Kalayan?"
"They bolted in different directions."
"You follow the Kalayan, right?"
Hadrian nodded. "Chased him clear across town, almost to the docks."
"And?"
"He went around a corner. I lost him for a bit. Then I tripped over his body.
He was dead.
Did you see who killed him?"
"Nope."
"Was his throat slit?"
"No.
Worse."
"How so?"
"His face was gone. Looked like it had been eaten."
Royce had excellent hearing. At that moment he could tell a mongrel dog was padding its way along the alley one block up, but he still wasn't certain he'd heard Hadrian correctly.
"Did you say eaten?"
Hadrian adjusted his scarf, tucking the ends inside the leather of his tunic.
"Chewed up pretty bad."
Royce leaned in. "Is that new?" He gestured at the knitted garment. Hadrian grinned and hooked his thumb, showing the blue-dyed wool in the hazy lamplight.
"Like it? I was down in the Calais section of town. That place never goes to sleep. All sorts of merchants still selling everything imaginable.
Honestly, you should go there.
I'll help you shop. We could get you a nice new cloak."
"Didn't see any polka dots, but there was a sweet yellow lemon one. You'd look good."
"What do you think?"
"You stopped to buy a scarf in the middle of the night."
Hadrian shrugged. "An impulse buy. I just happened to spot it at the fourth cart I went to. Actually, I was hoping for a whole cloak, but this was all I could find."
"You should get yourself one."
"Why?"
"Because it's blue.
And because I think having a face is a good thing."
Royce rolled his eyes. "Let's try to keep focused, shall we? What about the box? Let me guess, it was taken, and you didn't get a chance to look inside."
"Why would you assume that?"
"It's just the way these things always seem to go," Royce grumbled. "You either have a day when everything works out, or one when nothing does. Following the dwarf turned up only that he has a family and likes to carve wood. The guy you went after led nowhere, and the phantom who tried to flatten us with a slab of stone killed himself, denying me the opportunity to check his body. With such a grand set of circumstances, I must assume the box also vanished, thereby putting the perfect finish to a miserable day. We know where the dwarf lives. We can—
He'll be gone, along with his whole family.
You saw that place. They're as tight-knit as a sweater knotted out of human hair." Hadrian looked at him with that appalled expression he so often wore when Royce talked about drowning loud dogs or eliminating witnesses.
"A sweater? Made out of—"
"I'm just saying it's going to take a lot of torture to get anyone in that neighborhood to talk."
"We aren't torturing anyone."
Royce rolled his eyes.
"Well, I certainly wouldn't be taking you along if I was.
But it doesn't matter. They would only lie. To get the truth, I'd have to launch a complex operation where I could—"
"No torture, Royce."
Royce frowned. "So, to reiterate, the perfect finish to a miserable day."
"So pessimistic."
Hadrian shook his head slowly, frowning.
"I was thinking just the opposite. About how good the day turned out to be."
He raised his hand, spreading his fingers.
"Count with me."
He held back a finger. First, we managed to discover where the dwarf lived. He held back another. Second, we found two more suspects he was colluding with, and where they were meeting. Another finger. Third, we didn't get crushed by a block of granite. He bent another back. Fourth, the fellow you were chasing fell to his death, not you. Nor did you kill him, so we are also not wanted for murder this morning. I consider that a plus, even if you might not. He held back his thumb. Best of all, I still have a handsome face. Hadrian shook his five fingers at Royce like a child waving an enthusiastic hello. So you see, we had a very good day, and to prove it, let me put forth the evidence of the box. It wasn't taken, Mr. Grimm. I found it on the ground beside the Calaean. Apparently, all his assailant was after was the man's face. And inside... Hadrian's expression lost its buoyant sarcasm. Rocks. Rocks? Hadrian rolled his shoulders. Just a box of gravel. That's all that was inside. I dug through it, which I should get credit for, especially given that I was in a dark, foggy alley next to a faceless corpse, but yeah, it was just gravel. So, the box wasn't taken. But it turned out to be empty for all practical purposes, and you claim that as evidence that we had a good day. Still have a face. See? Hadrian grinned at him. Yes, I see. I see very well, in fact, which is part of why I don't accept it as conclusive proof that things worked out for the best. Hadrian scowled. Royce reached Hemsworth's door, and, as expected, it was locked. You just hate being happy, don't you? Hadrian asked. I have no idea. What's it like? If Royce needed any more evidence Hadrian was wrong about the day, he found it the moment he popped the lock and opened the door to the boarding house. Inside, Evelyn Hemsworth stood before him. She was dressed in a beige robe, her hair wrapped in a floral print scarf, her arms folded. She stared with a surprised expression that quickly soured. "How did you get in?" she asked accusingly. "I locked that door." "I guess I used the key you gave us." "I gave you nothing of the sort." "We rent a room here. How can you expect us to get in if you lock the door and don't give us a key?"
"I told you. I expect those under my roof to arrive during civilized hours. I don't approve of you slinking in at all hours like a pair of burglars. There's no legitimate reason for a body to be on the streets at this time of night. No reputable excuse. Now, as I did not, as I said, give you a key, how did you open that door?"
"You must have forgotten to lock it." Evelyn took a menacing step forward, glaring at Royce with a stern-faced expression. She jabbed at him with her forefinger.
"Don't get smart with me, young man. You know full well that door was locked, and that I never gave either one of you a key. Now, explain yourself."
Royce pointed at Hadrian. "He did it." Hadrian's brows went up.
"Did not."
Evelyn's eyes narrowed on Royce.
"You're dancing on the edge of a very steep cliff, my boy."
"What happened to treading on thin ice?" "I only ask because I don't dance." She ignored him.
"I don't like these late-night shenanigans the two of you have been conducting. I also don't like being woken from a dead sleep by someone banging on my door."
Royce glanced at Hadrian, who showed he was just as puzzled.
"We didn't knock."
"Not you." Evelyn shook a hand at them. "The other one. Got me up by threatening to break down my door. Hammered on it with his fists, which was utterly futile. My husband was a tax collector, you see. He took precautions against home invasion. Would take a battering ram to break this door. So, after tiring himself out and getting frustrated, he tried to convince me he was your brother.
She sniffed, indignantly.
As if I couldn't tell the difference.
I don't have a brother, Royce said.
Well, if you did, I wouldn't let him in either.
Not at that time of night. I told him I didn't care if he was related to the Duke. It was far too late to be banging on proper people's doors. If he had business with you, he would have to conduct it in the morning at a decent hour.
What did he say? Hadrian asked this time.
That he knew you weren't back, and he'd wait quietly in your room so I could go back to sleep.
You didn't let him in, did you?
Evelyn rolled her eyes.
What do you take me for?
Of course not.
The fellow was dressed up like a bandit in a dark hood and cloak, and soaking wet as if he'd just taken a bath in his clothes. And he was a mere.
She whispered this last bit, as if it was a dirty secret.
Which is proof he was lying about being your brother.
I certainly wasn't opening the door for a dishonest, drenched marauder.
Do you think me a fool?
That person was up to no good. Dangerous is what he was. And while you're under this roof, you're under my protection.
The bird is still alive, and he knows where we're staying.
Evelyn Hemsworth didn't look like any sort of bodyguard Royce would have picked, but there was no denying that she defended them from the most dangerous adversary Royce had encountered in years.
So, he finally left.
She leaned in toward Royce, her arms still folded, her eyes locked on his.
The two of you had better mend your ways. I can see you're falling in with a bad crowd. You both seem to be decent boys. Granted, a bit dim-witted and slow, but the captain of the city guard vouches for you, and—
Royce and Hadrian both raised their brows.
Don't look so surprised. When I heard you were picked up by the watchman, I was planning on throwing you out into the street. But then I asked Captain Weiberg about it, and he said it was all a misunderstanding. He also said that you two—
she nodded, rather than pointed in Hadrian's direction—
had served together. Still, this city has bad elements, and if you're not careful, you'll end up in trouble.
We don't want that, do we?
No, ma'am, Hadrian said. And I won't be having any more late-night visitors banging on my door, will I?
No, ma'am, Hadrian repeated.
And no more fiddling with my lock,
she said to Royce.
Agreed.
Yes, he replied.
Good.
She nodded curtly.
And don't be late for breakfast. I'm making waffles.
Chapter 16. Looking Away. Jenny had a razor-sharp edge on four of the silver coins. The key was a bigger issue. It made more noise when she scraped it, and the metal was much harder. She also couldn't grind it just anywhere, as she did with the coins. Those she scraped across the floor, and then covered the marks with straw. The key she had to file down carefully. Jenny needed to grind away all the teeth, except the top one. That meant she could only use rocks that protruded, providing an adequate edge. The rocks comprising the floor were flush and smooth. She was instead forced to scrape it against one of the three stones that jutted far enough out from the wall. Luckily, all three were hard and abrasive. And with nothing else to do, Jenny managed to reduce her trunk key into little more than a cylindrical barrel with a single tooth at the end, like a tiny, mouse-sized hoe. After nearly 2 weeks, the key was close to done, and so were Jenny's fingers. They throbbed, and her knuckles were a series of abrasions, two of which had scabs. Taking a break, she hid the key in the wall crevice. Then she lay down on the straw and sucked on her fingertips, staring at the ceiling. The underside was plaster. Parts of it had been painted. Most had faded. Other sections had chipped and fallen. An old bird's nest was in one corner. She wondered how a bird had gotten in.
then realized the door must be new.
Why am I still here? Why hasn't Leo agreed to the demands?
Even if her life wasn't in jeopardy, what Mercatus